Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 213 for August 15th, 2009. Coming up in a few minutes.
It was a big operation and a lot of people hustling around doing their thing. And my first day at the plant, I was just trying to find my way around the plant and find out what I was supposed to be doing.
That's the legendary Elmer T. Lee, Master Distiller Emeritus at Buffalo Trace. Today is his 90th birthday, and they celebrated with a party last night at the distillery in Frankfort, Kentucky. This year also marks the 50th anniversary of Elmer's joining Buffalo Trace. Back then it was known as the George T. Stagg Distillery. Elmer's a key figure in bourbon history for a couple of reasons. One, he's one of only three living distillers with a bourbon named after him. Second, he was the force behind the first commercially released single-barrel bourbon when Blanton's was introduced in 1984. And this is the 25th anniversary of that milestone. I had the chance to sit down with Elmer back in the fall of 2006, and you'll hear the entire interview in a few minutes. First, let's look at the week's news. Buffalo Trace used the birthday celebration to unveil a bunch of new releases, including the five that make up this year's antique collection. That's the George T. Stagg Bourbon, the William LaRue Weller Bourbon, the Eagle Rare 17-year-old Bourbon, the 18-year-old Sazerac Rye, and the Thomas H. Handy Sazerac Cask Strength Rye. There are also two new additions to the experimental collection range, double-barreled bourbons distilled in 1993 and 1997. They'll all go on sale in October, and I'll have more details as they're available. Also on the bourbon front, we're just a couple of weeks away from September 2nd, the birthday of Brown Forman founder George Garvin Brown. He was the first American distiller to bottle whiskey instead of selling it by the barrel, and each year Brown Forman releases a special Old Forester birthday bourbon to mark Brown's birthday. Master distiller Chris Morris selected the batch for this year's release.
We have selected a day's production from March the 19th of 1997, and for no other reason than I like numbers to work out, I thought 97 proof was a nice presentation of this neat flavor.
What's special
so
about this
size there? Well, this was a vintage of about 93 barrels. We thought we had a few more, but when you get into barrels of Old Forester of this age, Mark, because we still heat cycle our warehouses, we actually had five or so barrels that were completely dry. The Angels wiped those guys out, and our yield was very low as well, just because of that long Angel share. But this is a very robust example of the Old Forester birthday bourbon. It's really rich in oaked character, yet it still has some nice deep fruit notes and some delicate spice. It's a very mild, at 97 proof, it's a mild but very flavorful expression.
And this will go on sale, as you said, September 2nd, right?
Yes.
What markets?
Well, it's going to be available in a little wider range of markets because we've had such nice demand or requests for the brand. But that means some markets will get even less as we try to spread distribution out. And I apologize, I don't have all the markets in front of me. That's what the marketing guys have. But it's going to go to your primary bourbon markets, such as Chicago and New York, of course, and many markets in the Southeast where Old Forester has a very strong following.
I can't let you go without at least asking for your memories of Jimmy Bedford, because I know you guys worked together for a long time.
Oh, yes. Jimmy was a classic, of course, and he wasn't one to talk a whole lot, so sometimes his silence was volumes in itself. But he was a true gentleman, and he was absolutely dedicated to making Jack Daniels and the Jack Daniels family brands the best whiskey possible. And we had some good times together, and we'll certainly miss him.
Tell me about one of those good times, if you can.
Oh, sure. We were having a dinner together with a group of Brown Forman employees local salespeople down in Charleston, South Carolina, after we'd been doing some seminars together. And he started talking about his farm. And he was so, that was the second thing he was crazy about besides his family, was his farm. And the stories he would tell about working on the farm with his bulls and stuff, I can't repeat them on the air, but they were hilarious.
Somehow I had a feeling you wouldn't be able to repeat much of it. But he was a good man, and he will be missed.
Yes.
As I reported in the last episode, Jimmy Bedford passed away last Friday at his farm near Lynchburg, Tennessee. He was 69 years old. One more bourbon note, Heaven Hill is releasing a new version of its Evan Williams bourbon, sort of. It's mixed with honey and will be branded as Evan Williams Honey Reserve Kentucky Liqueur. It'll be available in selected markets starting in September. The Whiskey Exchange in London has released a new line of single cask bottlings under the Whiskey Society label. There are 8 whiskeys in the first release, all bottled at cask strength. The list includes Kalila's, distilled in 1982 and 1984, a pair of Rosebanks, 16 and 18 years old, and a 15-year-old Springbank single malt, distilled back in 1982. There's a link for more details at the Whiskey Cast website. Now, Macallan and Lefroig are at opposite ends of the single malt spectrum, but the Lang brothers have put the two together. Fred and Stuart Lang took a cask from each distillery and vatted them to make the first Douglas Lang double barrel release. It's bottled at 46% ABV and is hitting the market this month. Glendronach has a new single cask release distilled in 1996 coming out next month. Here's the catch, though. First, you have to go to Belgium. Then you have to track down the Glendronach van with the cask in the back. It'll be stopping at 7 Belgian retailers between September 29th and October 2nd for tasting sessions with the regular Glendronach range, and buyers will get to fill a bottle directly from the cask in the back of the van. Let's hope the van doesn't get stolen somewhere along the road. From the What I'm Tasting This Week department, I received a sample of the Isle of Skye 8-year-old blended scotch to taste. This one is billed as a mix of island and Speyside malts, and the nose clearly reveals the coastal influence. The name would suggest some Talisker content, and it has a smokiness reminiscent of Talisker. There's also a lighter note of heather and grass underneath the smoke. The taste is smokier than the nose, though. The peat reveals itself here, along with a brininess that lingers into the finish. I also get some nutty notes, mostly almonds and hazelnuts. It's a good solid blend that's worth a try if you like smoky whiskeys. I'm scoring it an 83. Now, I've had a mini of a 1990 Little Mill Lowland single malt bottled by Signatory that's been sitting on the shelf for a while. I finally got around to drinking it. It's very aromatic on the nose, with notes of green apples and cinnamon. And even though it was bottled at 43% ABV, it has a strong alcohol burn in the nose. The taste is syrupy, thick, and spicy, with a minimal burn and a strong peppery kick at first. Water tones down the spice and brings out a nice apple pie flavor with a slight hint of nutmeg. The finish is dry and short, though, and on the whole it's a bit lacking in balance. I had hoped for a longer finish. I'm scoring this one a 79. Again, these are just my impressions, and you should take your own tastes into account when selecting a dram. You'll find a list of my highest-rated whiskeys on the ratings page of the WhiskeyCast website. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Lefroig. Let's go through some of the major events coming up this fall so you can plan your travel schedule. Whiskey Live Sydney is coming up August 31st through September 6th. Check the archives for last month's episode 207 for more details. Whiskey Live Glasgow is September 12th. The Kentucky Bourbon Festival is September 15th through the 20th in Bardstown. The Autumn Speyside Whiskey Festival is September 25th through the 29th in and around Dufftown. Whiskey Live Paris is September 26th through the 28th, as we heard last week. Malt Advocate is getting several rare whiskeys for the charity tasting table at Whiskey Fest San Francisco on October 16th. The Whiskey Show London makes its debut on November 6th and 7th, and Malt Advocate takes Whiskey Fest to New York on November 10th. Those are just a few of the many events happening around the world this fall. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Lefroig Quarter Cask.
Hi there, my name's John Campbell, Distillery Manager at Lefroig Distillery. Become a friend of Lefroig. Claim your own square foot of Islay at lefroig.com.
When I'm 90 years old, I want to be like Elmer T. Lee, sharp, quick-witted, and still enjoying a glass of bourbon every day. Today is Elmer's 90th birthday, and Buffalo Trace is releasing a special 90th birthday edition of Elmer T. Lee Bourbon in his honor. As I've said before, Elmer is one of only three living bourbon distillers with a whiskey named after him. Jimmy Russell and Parker Beam are the other two. In the fall of 2006, I got to spend a few minutes chatting with Elmer about his years in the whiskey business, and this is a first. I've never repeated an entire interview before on WhiskeyCast, but then again, not many master distillers make it to their 90th birthday.
I grew up in the town that Buffalo Trace is located in, and I knew it from my kid up. After I got out of college with an engineering degree, They were looking for engineers, and I was interested. I went to work for them in 1949.
What was it like growing up around the distillery back then?
Everybody knew the distillery and the distillery people. They were friendly, a good place to work. It was just a sort of a big family atmosphere.
But it wasn't always that way. If I remember correctly, there were a number of those years when you were growing up when there wasn't a Buffalo Trace distillery because of the Great Experiment.
No, it operated during that period of time. One of the four distillers in Kentucky that continued to operate under a medicinal permit and made medicinal whiskey and bottled. And people who had a pain went to their doctor, got a prescription, got it filled. They could get four bottles a month, was it? Four pint bottles a month. And cured their ills.
I never quite thought of it as medicinal, but I can understand why.
It's labeled as such. You look at some of those old Prohibition-era labels, and it says bottle for medicinal purposes.
Now, what happened after Prohibition ended and the distillery kicked back in full strength producing bourbon for everybody?
Well, there was 200 or 300 distilleries in Kentucky, and quite a number of them went under during the Prohibition era. So when they started back up in 1933, 34, why, of course, they didn't have any aged bourbon. They had to start all from scratch again. And they went full blast. They went good.
Tell me about your first day working at the distillery. What was it like to go in there on that first day back in 49?
It was a hustling place. At that time, there was about 400 people working at the plant. It was a big operation and a lot of people hustling around doing their thing. And my first day at the plant, I was just trying to find my way around the plant and find out what I was supposed to be doing.
And what did they have you doing?
I was an engineer, plant engineer, which meant that you took care of building needs, maintenance needs, new construction, new equipment, modernization, mechanization, the things that engineers do.
And how did you make the transition into distilling?
After about 12 years of this as an engineer, the plant was pretty well where they wanted it to be, and they offered me an opportunity to learn the distilling trade as an art and to understudy the master distiller and the plant manager. This I did, and after about 4 years, I became manager of the plant.
What to you makes a good bourbon?
What makes a good bourbon? Takes a good recipe. It takes a people who are interested in what they're doing and do it with pride and care and put it away in the warehouse and age it for the required number of years, bottle it, put it on the market.
Did you ever expect that you'd spend your entire life pretty much there?
No, I didn't. But after I was there a few years, like most people would, I shopped around in other industries and quickly decided that I was where I belonged, and I stayed with it.
Tell me about the average day when you go into a distillery. When you go in there, what's it smell like? What's it sound like? For those of us who've never been to a distillery, sort of paint that picture for us of what it's like in there.
You would be impressed, I think, with the sugar smell. It's a sweet, the mashing of the grains and the conversion over to with barley malt, the conversion over, you get a sweet smell, and this impermeates the whole area around there. This is what you'd witness or would be impressed with first, I think, is the smell. And then, if you was interested, you'd want to find out where that good smell was coming from and take a tour of the plant, and they'd offer you a little drink of their bourbon, and you'd like it.
What's the secret, in your opinion, to storing and aging bourbons? I know a lot of folks like to rotate the barrels around the warehouses and stuff like that, and what's your secret? What do you think makes it age so well?
Well, the territory we are in is Kentucky's climate is constantly changing. The Army guys had a good word for it, said if you don't like the weather in Kentucky, just wait a few minutes. You know, it's going to change. The changing seasons, the changing weather is very important to the aging of bourbon.
How so?
With the increased temperatures that occur, it forces the whiskey in the barrel into the wood, and the wood is, of course, got a lot of sugars and taste characteristics about it that when it cools off and withdraws from the wood, it brings those tastes with it. You get all of the most of the taste and all of the color comes from the barrel, the aging process. When it's first made, it's clear as water and put in a barrel. And in a few days, it'll pick up some color and will start to take on characteristics of bourbon.
Now, I know that a lot of people differ on the amount of aging a barrel should have. What's your opinion? What's the ideal age for a bourbon?
It depends on a person's preference, taste. But to my taste, 7 to 10 years is where it reaches its peak, I think.
Does it go downhill after that in some ways?
Depends on your taste preference. It does change taste as it ages. Pick up more of the tannins, more of the wood taste. If you like that, you like it older. If you don't care for it too much, you'd prefer it at 8 to 10 years age.
Now, what's changed about the industry over the years, both good and bad? What don't you like about the way things have changed, and what do you like?
Well, there's not many things that I don't like about it. There has been a change, of course, in the equipment, modernization, mechanization, computer control, this sort of thing, which is good, I think, because it gives you better control of your process. So you put out a product that's consistent year in and year out. Those are the good things, I think. The bad things, and they're not really bad, but I hate to see the thing become too mechanized and too modernized. It takes the romance out of the operation.
And whiskey making really is sort of a romantic, passionate type thing. A still maker or still man handing out, working over the still, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Now, you retired a few years ago officially, but do you miss it?
Well, not too much, because I go in quite frequently. I retired 20 years ago. And I still go into the plant on a routine basis once a week, do a series of tastings of the single barrel products, and serve on a committee that selects barrels for single barrel production. Then I touch base with folks like Angela and Mac and the personnel people, the gift shop. You know, I just make myself at home and roam around.
How do the bourbons today compare? Because you talked about being able to get more consistency with computer control. Are the bourbons of today just as good as the bourbons you were making back in the 40s and 50s?
Yes, it certainly is. In fact, it may be a little better because of the consistency. With the controls that's now on the process with instruments and computer and people who pay attention to what they're doing, you put out a more consistent product, and it's a good product. I think it's better than what we did in the 30s.
I know your colleagues over in Scotland would say that the whiskeys they were making back in the 50s and 60s are superior to what they're making today just because of changes in barley and things like that. But it's interesting to hear you say that you're actually making better bourbon now than you did 30, 40 years ago.
To my taste, yes, we're making better bourbon.
I have to ask, since you're talking about taste, how do you take your bourbon?
How do I taste it? Well, at the tasting panel, you have some distilled water, rinse your mouth with distilled water, and then you take a sip of the product that you're tasting, swirl it around in your mouth, let your taste buds in contact with the product, and if you like it, why, you like it, you know, you spit it out, and then you do the same thing for the next sample that you're...
If I remember reading correctly in your bio, you're sort of the one who came up with the idea of marketing single barrel bourbons. Am I correct on that? Why did you come up with that idea? How did you come up with it? And what did the folks at the distillery say when you said, let's do single barrels?
The owners of the plant at that time was looking for a premium product that they wanted to be in competition, so to speak, with the single malt scotch program, which was very successful. So I was manager at the plant at the time, and they came to me and says, what would you do? How would you suggest we come up with a premium product? And I remembered some of the things I had learned when I first went to work there from Colonel Albert Blanton. Whenever he wanted bourbon for his own personal use and for entertainment, he'd go to his favorite warehouse and ask them to bring him samples out of aged bourbon, 7, 8, 10 years old. He would sip them, and he would pick a particular barrel and say, bottle that one, that's the one I want. This sounded like a pretty marketable idea to the people that owned the plant. So they said, we'll come up with a single barrel bourbon. So the first one was Albert, named after Blanton, Albert Blanton.
Tell me about Colonel Blanton.
Well, I only worked with him 4 years before he retired. He was a true Kentucky gentleman, quiet, good-natured, knew his business, had a great love of the plant and the products. He was part owner of the property at that time. He was a real gentleman. I like Colonel Blanton.
And now we're looking 40, 50 years later, and now you've got your name on a bottle of bourbon.
Yeah, I have. When I retired in 1986, the owners at that time said, Elmer, we'd like to name a bourbon after you. I said, fine, you can do it, provided you let me pick the bourbon. So they agreed, and I'm picking the bourbon for it still.
And what do you look for when you pick that bourbon?
Something that's very mild and mellow to my taste. I like the caramel, the sweetness that I get from it, the vanilla, oaken flavors, all of those things that are pleasing to my taste is what I look for.
I know that you and Jimmy Russell are the only two distillers alive that have your own have a bourbon named after you. That's got to be something of a matter of pride for you.
It is. There was three of us, of course, Booker Noel, who's now passed away, but they're the only three distillers that I know that have a bourbon named for them. Jimmy Russell's, Russell's Reserve, Elmer T. Lee, and Booker's.
Let me ask you one final question. What do you want your legacy to be in this business? How do you want people to remember you 20, 30 years from now?
I want people to remember me as being knowledgeable of the business, the craft, and someone who was fair and honest with, in dealing with them. I want people at the plant to remember me as a good manager.
And a good whiskey maker.
Oh, yeah. That was part of it. That's right.
That's the one and only Elmer T. Lee, 90 years old today. Finally, I'd like to acknowledge another birthday. My father, Phil, isn't quite as old as Elmer. He turned 69 years old yesterday on the 14th. Happy birthday, Dad. And that's all for this episode of Whiskey Cast. You'll find links to my Twitter feed and the Whiskey Cast Facebook page, along with the calendar of events, a page full of whiskey links, my whiskey ratings, the Whiskey Cast store, and a complete archive of past episodes at the Whiskey Cast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. I'm still gathering questions for the next Q&A episode. If there's something you've always wondered about whiskey, email me your question, and I'll try to find someone to answer it for you. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2009, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.